On the 14th of April, the White Star liner Titanic, on her maiden voyage from Southampton to New York, struck an iceberg and sank to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
The Icy Grave.
When I first saw the Titanic, to see it just there was like, well, you're not supposed to be here. You don't belong here, was one reaction you have. And then the other one is, oh my God, this thing is huge. Because you can't see the Titanic all at once in the deep sea. You just see this wall of steel. And it looks like the gates to Troy, I mean, or the side of a pyramid. I mean, it's overwhelming in its size. And you're down on your hands and knees at the very base of it, looking up.
There was this great successful ship with this marvelous popular old captain, the very image of a fin de siècle master mariner, the owner on board, all those famous people, and they hit an iceberg on a fine, clear night.
An account of the tragic loss of the Titanic and the search for her final resting place, 2.5 miles down on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean. Told by some of the survivors, retired ship's captain Commodore John Washer and oceanographer Dr. Robert Ballard.
Initially, my interest in the Titanic was technological. I began to dream up a new exploration technology in 1979, 1980. And then time came to test it and go to sea with it. And I just said, well, let's go look for the Titanic. Because it's nearby, Cape Cod. And other people had tried to find it and had failed, so it was sort of a challenge. So I studied the Titanic, focusing on how to find it. But in the process of that, became drawn into the ship and its mystique and its stories.
The Titanic, of course, had everything. She was the latest ship. She was built like the grandest hotel of the day, if not more so. Some of her staterooms were 50 feet long. They even had coal fires in their grate. There were Adam fireplaces. There were Doric marbles. There were great halls in the first class. She was more like the interior of a stately home than a ship. She became known before she went to sea as the unsinkable ship. There was an article in the journal Engineering describing all the marbles, her furniture, her construction, and it said there, because of the watertight bulkheads, because of the double bottom, she is practically indestructible. Now, this phrase got misappropriated in the popular press, and the word practically got lost in the media hype before she sailed.
It's a big ocean. It's overwhelming. In fact, when you get out there for the first time and you begin the search, you feel a little bit stupid that you're even trying. And it took you days to get there, and you went through this vast emptiness. And it's sort of ludicrous when they say, well, we're here. You know, you end up with an area of 100 to 150 square miles. Somewhere in that vast region is the ship, and then it's in total darkness. It's at great depth, tremendous pressure, currents, mountain ranges. I mean, the ocean is not flat. You know, it contains vast, complex countrysides. It's like dropping a ship in the Alps. And to be presumptuous enough to think you're going to go and find the needle in the haystack.
The discovery of the Titanic, 13.5 miles east-southeast of her distress position, does highlight some of the difficulties of navigation 80 years ago. Today, ships and aircraft expect to know their position to a matter of feet or hundreds of yards 24 hours a day, and it is so easy for them. In those days, once a ship was out of sight of land, The only way they could obtain their position was by celestial observations, the sun, the stars, and the moon. Now, such navigation is accurate in fine, clear weather to plus or minus 2 miles, which is adequate. In the case of the Titanic, her last known position was twilight, and so between the time she fixed her position and the time she collided with the iceberg, about 9 hours had passed. Now, during that time, she would have run on what is known as dead reckoning, just the direction she went and the number of miles.
I decided not to look for the ship with sonar, which is what most people do, but to look for debris and to follow the debris to the ship, to look for a scent and to do that visually. People thought that was nuts, you know, you're going to go down and visually look for this thing in total darkness. I mean, you could miss it by a few feet. But I knew enough about tracking animals. And an animal's trail is longer than the animal. And you pick up the footprints of the animal and you follow them, track them, until you track down the animal.
On April the 10th, that's 1912, she sailed on her maiden and only voyage for New York. From the moment we left Belfast, we had marvelous weather. It was as smooth as the proverbial mill pond. In any other circumstances, those conditions would have been ideal. But anyone with experience of ice at sea knows that those very conditions and the moonless night only render the detection of icebergs all the more difficult.
Ice navigation presents many problems. They relied on visual observation because they had nothing else to rely on. They used to hope that there would be a little bit of wind because the wind would break against the icebergs and make ripples and breakers on the water, which could be seen maybe 3/4 of a mile ahead. Ice also gives off a glow under certain conditions, but on this particular night, it was a dark night with no moon. Icebergs also have dark sides where some of the ice is blue ice, and these are not so readily seen. It is not known which side presented to the lookout at the Titanic's masthead. In addition to that, the greater part of the tragedy is that the Titanic received between 4 and 6 warnings of ice from other vessels. The most sad and disastrous occurrence was that a warning given by the Mesaba 2 hours before the collision, clearly indicating ice very near, or if not across, the Titanic's path, was never delivered to the bridge because the radio officer was so busy sending out passenger signals to friends in New York. His priority was to please the customer, and somehow or other, the signal, the last warning of ice, never reached Captain Smith.
We were steaming that night at a good 22 knots. At 10 o'clock, I was relieved as officer of the watch by Murdoch. I expect his watch went on as mine had done. Nothing to see and nothing to hear, except the distant roar of the water at her bows, when there were 3 sharp clangs on the crow's nest bell, followed by a cry from the lookout cage, "Ice right ahead, sir."
At the time when the iceberg was reported from the crow's nest, I was sitting in my cabin having a cup of tea, and immediately got up and walked along to the bridge, about 60 feet away on the same deck, when the crash came, and it didn't break my step.
After the gala dinner, I walked down the hallway, and just before going to my stateroom, there was a bump. As I turned the handle, there was another bump. As I got into my room, there was a third bump. Nothing very violent. And I slipped on a coat over my white satin evening dress and went right out. And as I got out on the deck, I saw a large gray, well, it looked to me like a building floating by, bumping along the rail, and ice fell all over the deck. And I, and a great many of my foolish fellow passengers, picked up the ice and started to play snowballs. We thought it was fun. We asked the officers if there was any danger. They said, no, nothing at all. Just a mere nothing. We just hit an iceberg.
And I got to the bridge, and the captain evidently arrived about the same moment. And I heard him say to Murdoch, what's the matter? What have you stuck? He said, we're stuck in an iceberg, sir. He said, I'm going full speed astern, sir, on the port engine. He swung her head round towards port, and she was on the swing. And that's why she was torn underneath. She was penetrated in 6 compartments.
The Titanic was beautifully built. You could take the Titanic and saw off the front portion of the ship and it wouldn't sink. But the ship was literally stapled together by rivets. It was not welded. It didn't have welding technology. So basically they took a bunch of plates and stapled them. And when the Titanic hit the iceberg, it popped its staples. See, it wasn't the size of the opening that sank the Titanic. It's the fact that it stretched through so many watertight compartments. The opening, on average, was about 1 or 2 inches. Ironically, had they not tried to avoid the iceberg, had they just gone right into it, they wouldn't have sunk. But the natural tendency of a person is to dodge. So they did what the only human would do, but the irony is, had they done nothing, they probably wouldn't have sank.
I didn't get down to the foredeck because I met a mail clerk coming up. And he said, Mr. Vauxhall, the mail room's filling. So I said, oh, carry on. I said, I'll go down there and have a look. So I continued on my way down to the mail room, and I was standing on the top of a companionway from the sorting room down to the handling room. And I saw a bag floating by. I realized then that it was serious.
The order had been given, all hands on deck. When the boats were stripped and cleared, they were swung out and lowered to the level of the boat deck. Just a little while before they were ready to swing out, I happened to meet the captain. And I asked him, shall I get the women and children away, sir? He just nodded. So I started to fill the first boat. I told them it was merely a precaution and that very likely they'd all be taken on board again at daylight, or at the worst, taken on board the ship everyone could clearly see only a few miles away.
The greatest part of the tragedy, of course, is that there was a ship within 20 miles of the Titanic whose radio officer had gone off a watch a few minutes before the Titanic sent out her distress calls. The Californian was stopped in the ice in a position which she said was 19 and a half miles to the north-northeast of the Titanic. Captain Lord, her master, was an experienced, dedicated man with a very good record. On the night of the disaster, both Californian and Titanic saw a ship cross their paths. Captain Lord then went and turned in, not in his cabin, but on the bridge behind the chart room, in his sea clothes. He didn't undress, and he told the officer to let him know of anything untoward. His officer of the watch saw rockets low down on the horizon and sent down to Captain Lord. Captain Lord did not get up. He said, well, they could well be signal rockets from ships exchanging recognition signals. In those days, ships very often fired rockets to identify themselves. There was no radio telephones in those days, and unfortunately, rockets were also a distress signal. Captain Lord was made, to a great extent, a scapegoat, and at Lord Mersey's inquiry, they endeavoured to show that his ship was within 7 or 8 miles of the Titanic rather than 19 and a half miles. The controversy is sad and complicated.
Now, we were told we were only going to leave because it was rules and regulations. No danger whatsoever. We'd all be back for breakfast. And I thought it was perfectly asinine to leave a warm, comfortable ship to come back for breakfast. Why? The English have got rules and regulations, but they're just plumb crazy. I'm sticking to this ship. So I went to bed.
Well, there were actually cases where women absolutely refused to be put in a boat. I remember one young couple, evidently not long married, walking up and down the boat deck. I asked the girl if I should put her in a boat. But no, she wouldn't be parted from her husband. Not on your life, she said. We've started together, and we'll finish together.
I was in bed, and some man knocked at the door and said, "Madam, get up. They're claiming that women and children should leave the ship." So I got out of bed. I only had one woolen dress that was out. A sheath dress, so tight that from my hips to my ankles, I was practically, well, I would say I was in a potato sack. I couldn't walk. I had a hobble. In those days, they were called hobble skirts. And I put on a wool cap. And the thinnest fur coat I had, a broadtail, which I might as well have put a tissue paper on. I couldn't have been dressed more ridiculously.
Now, between lowering one boat and another, I frequently took a run forward and a quick look down a long stairway that led from the boat deck three or four decks down. Frankly, I'm never likely to forget the sight of that cold, greenish water creeping step by step up that stairway. Some of the lights were shining down on the water, and others, already submerged, were giving it a sort of ghastly transparency. But for my purpose, I could tell by that staircase measurement how far down she'd gone and how quickly she was going.
And I found a gentleman standing at the rail, and he said to me, "Hello, come on, you're going to get off of this ship." And I said, "Not me. How do you expect me to get off of anything with this thing I've got on? I'm a prisoner in my own skirt. I can't even walk, much less get up to that rail and then jump across the ocean into a lifeboat. Oh, no, not me." "Well," he said, "you'll have to." So he made a cradle of his hands with another gentleman, and he threw me head foremost, and I fell in the bottom of the boat and found that I was the next to last passenger in the last lifeboat and the only lifeboat that was full.
You've got to remember, there weren't enough boats to take half the people, and the chances of the other half in that icy cold water were absolutely nil. Yet, there was never the slightest attempt to get into a boat out of turn. In fact, with the last couple of boats, it was even difficult to find women to fill them, though, of course, there were still a good many on board.
The Titanic was fitted with lifeboats way and beyond the Board of Trade's requirements of the time, with a total capacity of 1,178 persons. But on the night of the disaster, she had nearly 2,500 on board. Now, this seems to be a sad discrepancy. But, of course, what happens is that legislation tends to lag behind technical advance. And the Titanic was such an advance in size and scope and scale of ships that she, in fact, had outrun the legislation for her boats.
The ship took a sudden dip, and a sea came rolling up, carrying everyone with it. For my part, I took a header from the top of the wheelhouse. I started to swim away, but got sucked down two or three times. In fact, I got mighty near the edge of things before I finally came up alongside the collapsible. We'd hove into the water from the top of the officers' quarters, and there I hung on. A bit later, the forward funnel guys carried away, and the funnel, weighing perhaps 50 or 60 tons, fell down with a crash on the water. It missed the raft by inches and flung us clear of the ship altogether. Several of us scrambled up onto the slippery bottom of the raft, and it was from there I saw the Titanic sink. Up to that moment, she had stood out as clear with her rows of electric lights all burning. When the boilers broke away, she was, of course, plunged into absolute darkness. Though her huge black outline was still perfectly distinct up against the stars and sky. Then, quite quietly, quicker and quicker, she seemed just to slide away under the surface and disappear.
Well, we'd got away clear of the ship, and we just laid on the oars and until eventually they realized that she'd gone, and we heard all the screams. We couldn't do anything.
So the bow began to be pulled under, and that would lever the stern into the air. So the stress really began to build up amidship, where the ship was weakest and where the big rooms were and the lack of structural integrity. And that's where the ship broke off. Now you have two ships sinking, the bow and the stern. The bow is flooded, and that saved it from destruction because it now became pressure compensated. It was now full of water. There was no pressure effects. The stern was full of air and buttoned up and undamaged, except at the tear, which caused it to sink, but now began to sink faster than the air could get out. And at probably, 1,500 feet or so, maybe a tenth of the way down, it went off like a bomb and imploded and became reduced to a almost non-recognizable heap of metal. Now the bow, because it's intact and hydrodynamic, would still glide. And so it did. It glided away from the stern. The stern just fell as a big hunk of metal straight down. And then the debris poured off of it in the currents. Lighter materials, people, everything streamed away from it. As it sank, the wind of the sea blew the rest downwind. And that's what's down there. I landed on the deck of the Titanic, up near the grand staircase, and then I sent this little robot down inside. And I became a little robot. As I was sitting in the submarine, it was just three of us, and it was dark, and we were looking at the monitor, and we became that little robot. And it was frightful. It was like kids exploring a cave and scared, you know, not knowing, well, what am I going to find? And you go up and you peek in windows. And you can hear the parties, and you can hear the people. It's like it's at night and the ship's underway. You'll shine a light into the interior of the Titanic, and it hits a window or a mirror and bounces back at you. It's like someone's inside. To read little signs inside the ship. This door for crew use only. First class entrance. You read these little brass plates all over. And then to go into a room, big room, and to become almost enveloped in darkness with, you couldn't see anything at that moment. The room was so large, you couldn't see any far wall, and you were just suspended in black space, and then to have coming out of that, of chandelier. You're just, and you know, I can't believe what you're seeing. I mean, here was a ship that had hit an iceberg and broke in half and fell vertically and went 12,000 feet and smashed into the ocean floor, and then there's a light fixture still hanging from the ceiling. We found where the bodies landed because there were pairs of shoes everywhere. If a shoe falls from the surface, it's not going to land next to another shoe 12,000 feet below. Imagine a body floating to the ocean floor. Well, it's quickly eaten down to the skeleton. And the clothes are eaten, because most clothes were cotton, and they weren't polyester. And the skeleton is eaten and dissolves, and it vanishes. The only thing left are the shoes, because they've been treated with tannic acid. They're not edible to these animals, so they don't eat the shoes. So all over the debris field were the pairs of shoes. Little children's shoes, women's shoes, men's shoes. I saw pairs of shoes all over the place.
As a result of this terrible disaster, many new regulations were made. Most important of all, to carry more lifeboats for every soul on board. In due course, the Americans set up an ice patrol to seek out icebergs and to give ships timely warning. All passenger ships were to have 3 radio officers, not 2. In due course, out of this, evolved something equally important, that for cargo ships who only carry 1 radio officer, because they don't really need 3, but to preserve safety when that man is off duty, eventually automatic alarms were fitted, so that if any ship sent an SOS, the ship was alerted on her bridge and in the radio officer's cabin. The other major change was that regular boat drills were instigated for members of the crew, and perhaps even more significantly, that members of the crew who were not sailors were to be trained in lifeboat procedures.
I remember driving in the debris area for the first time, and I was looking out of the window of my submarine, which is very close to the bottom, only 2 feet away, and I was coasting along looking at an angle, so objects would come into my window with no warning and close, and a head went into my window, and I almost had a heart attack. I mean, my heart just raced as I saw this face looking back at me. And it was a porcelain doll's head. But it took a while for my mind to identify it. Doll's head. And it was frightful. And all throughout it you would see personal objects.
Dr. Ballard's discovery of the wreck prompted a new inquiry, because new evidence may have been revealed. This inquiry was carried out by the Marine Accident Investigation Board. The findings of this inquiry have just been published. They support Captain Lord by saying that his ship was, in fact, 17 to 19 miles away from the Titanic. They confirm that the rockets seen by the Californians' officers were rockets fired by the Titanic. But they conclude, in the end, that proper action was not taken by Captain Lord. Perhaps equally significant in this human tragedy is that even if Captain Lord had made the correct decision that the rockets were distress rockets, had got his ship underway and made for the Titanic, it is very unlikely that he would have got there in time to save many lives, because people in the water in the Greenland Current die very quickly.
People say, what was it like to visit the Titanic? Well, you search your previous experiences to find something that you can explain that they would have a better understanding for. And in the United States, there are a number of battlefields from the Civil War. There was this tremendous battle called Gettysburg. And you go there and you walk the battlefield. And if you've studied it, you know exactly what took place there. The Union had set up their lines, and the Confederates charged across an open cornfield. As they ran across this field, they just were slaughtered. There's a little sign at that very spot, and you're standing there, and you cry. You cry, because you can feel that battle all around you. And when I was at the Titanic, you cry. You feel it. It's there. You can hear it. You can breathe it. It's very powerful. And for someone to go there and desecrate it is wrong. And when I just can't stand the thought of people going there and desecrating that battlefield of life.
The Icy Grave featured Titanic survivors Charles Lightoller, Joseph Boxhall, and Edith Russell, with Commodore John Weisher and Dr. Robert Ballard. The program was compiled and produced by Peter Rawlings.